This is Leon Gortler interviewing Ron Breslau in his office at Columbia University on April 9th, 1999. This is the second part of our oral history interview. I had gotten up to hydrophobicity. I'm sorry.
Right.
In 1980, you began publishing material on reactions of organic molecules in water,
right,
where there were significant rate increases, and that is over reactions in organic solvents. And one of the earliest findings concerned the rate enhancement for the Diels-Alder reaction. And the question is how the research began. In my own mind, I thought, gee, somebody dropped the stuff in the water accidentally.
No. We had, of course, been studying reactions that occurred in cyclodextrins. And for things to bind into a cyclodextrin, you have to be in water because that's a hydrophobic binding. And so I asked one of my new graduate students to see if we could make a Diels-Alder reaction occur inside the cavity, because I thought that there was a good chance that the diene and the dienophile would both pack together inside the cavity and the reaction would be accelerated as a result and possibly even directed in terms of geometry. And all of that was actually true. It did happen. But we also found that in the control reaction, when we omitted the cyclodextrin, we also got big rate effects. They weren't as big. The cyclodextrin was better, but that's a special situation. But the thing that we found in the control was that the water reaction also was much faster than any other solvent. So we realized that water produces a cage as well. It just happens to be a spontaneous cage, and that the reactions were going on inside a water cage, and that that was an interesting thing to pursue. And we're still doing it to this day.
Oh, okay.
We're still pursuing hydrophobic effects to this day. The Diels-Alder story is largely finished, I think. We started that and showed both that we got rate accelerations and that we also got very big increases in selectivity. That is, the molecules came together so as to minimize the exposed surface area. So we got, for instance, in the high 90% of endo product, where things are very compact, right, whereas in other solvents you generally get a mixture of some kind. And so that actually has been picked up and studied by a number of other people. Paul Grieco then picked that up and used this water effect to direct some Diels-Alder reactions that were of interest in terms of sort of natural product synthesis. And a man named Engberts in Holland, E-N-G-B-E-R-T-S, who's always been quite interested in the properties of water and reactions in water, he picked up our stuff and ran with it too. And so there have been other people looking at this. At some point after that, we decided, well, even then we realized that it's one thing to say that reactions are faster in water. It's another thing to know that it has to do with the hydrophobic effect. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that protein chemists knew that there were materials that would decrease the hydrophobic effect. They knew for a long time that there were materials that would denature proteins, and they began to realize that this is because the hydrocarbons that are normally in the interior of a protein get exposed to the water as a result of diminishing the hydrophobic effect with the so-called denaturants. But some of the fundamental work on it, there was a man named Arnold Wishnia, who did at Stony Brook, who did some studies of the solubility of hydrocarbons in water and as they were affected by these denaturants. And he showed that hydrocarbon solubility increased with these denaturants, so that, you know, protein is a complicated thing. You could be changing hydrogen bonds and who knows what. But he showed that the hydrophobic thing was a major factor for these denaturants, that they did, in fact, increase solubility of hydrocarbons, which meant it didn't cost you as much energy to put a hydrocarbon next to water, you know, which is what that effect was. And so these were, at that time they were called denaturants, sometimes they were called water structure breakers, but that involved the idea that we knew how it happened.
Right.
And so with one of my students, we looked into the question of whether one really knew why it was that this solubility increased. At the same time, it was known that things like lithium chloride, sodium chloride, would decrease hydrocarbon solubility. That's a well-known salting out effect, right, and people use that even in the laboratory to make things extract better. So that was known, and what was known about that was that you get a decrease. You get so-called electrostriction, a decrease in volume of the solvent. As you put the sodium chloride in the water, the volume goes down, and the volume goes down, and therefore, in a sense, you squeeze out the empty spaces, or putting it another way, if you want to dissolve something in that water, you've got to create a space, and now you have to fight against this salt effect that's pulling it in the other direction. So that was electrostriction, and so a lot of people assumed that the denaturants just worked in the other direction, that is, they made it easier to make a hole in the water rather than harder. But we looked at that because if that were true, then the denaturants should actually decrease the surface tension, because when you make a hole, you're creating more surface, and so if it's easier to make a hole, the surface tension should go down. But in fact, these denaturants increase the surface tension.
Right.
And so as a result of that, we concluded that it wasn't because you made water open up more easily, but it was because things like urea, which is a denaturant, would be able to sit on the hydrocarbon and help solvate it, because it's a better solvator than water is, and also bridge to the water. And so they simply intervened between the water and the hydrocarbon, and that's, you know, it was a solvation effect and not a water-breaking structure effect. And so we decided we don't want to call the only denaturants, because that's too narrow a term, because it has to do with the idea that you're denaturing something, but after all, you're really solubilizing even hydrocarbons, so denaturant doesn't seem like a good word for that. And we didn't want to call them water structure breakers, because that's not how they work, and so that didn't seem sensible.
Right.
So we turned them anti-hydrophobic agents,
okay,
because they, in fact, decrease the hydrophobic effect. It's sort of just a description of them. And we've pursued that ever since, and have done a lot of work with that. I don't know how much of that you wanted me to go
but
on.
Yeah, in fact, that was my next question. In fact, many times you've just used organic solvents that have been miscible with ethanol.
Yeah, well, what happened is that we originally did a study with the benzoin condensation. We decided, you know, the Diels-Alder reaction, it was clear that the two components had to come together because that was the product. But in the benzoin condensation, we thought there was a good chance that the benzaldehyde and the mandelonitrile anion, this is a sort of cyanohydrin anion, when they came together, we thought there was a good chance that the phenyl rings would also sit on top of each other, because if you think about the geometry, the stereoelectronic requirements of that, it did seem as if these phenyls should be able to get at each other. So one of my very good graduate students, I must say, a man named Eric Kuhl, K-O-O-L, who's now at the University of Rochester, Kuhl took up this benzoin study, and he studied the benzoin condensation in water with added reagents like lithium chloride, and in fact the reaction speeded up. But then when he used lithium perchlorate, which is an anti-hydrophobic agent, which in fact dissolves hydrocarbons in terms of lithium perchlorate, makes benzene more soluble in water, makes other hydrocarbons more soluble also. So the perchlorate anion is the point. If you have a large ion, that large ion can generally solvate a hydrocarbon, and if it has some charge on it, it can bridge through the water, and so it works, you know, in this solvation mode. Anyhow, so he looked at it, and lithium perchlorate decreased the rate. And so we saw this contrast then between a pro-hydrophobic and an anti-hydrophobic agent, and the rate indicated that what was going on with the benzoin condensation was not just water better solvating some charges, but was in fact some hydrocarbon packing. But then we decided that if we looked at those curves, we should be able to interpret them in terms of how much of each benzene covers the other one. In other words, are they fully eclipsed, or is there some partial covering or whatever? We should be able to do that in principle, but I didn't like using the salts for that, because I was afraid that ionic strength effects could be something that we wouldn't really understand well enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to ethanol, because ethanol will also do this, and in fact I don't think anybody has any doubt that the way ethanol solubilizes a hydrocarbon is to have the ethyl group sit against the hydrocarbon,
right,
and the OH sit in the water. I mean, that's pretty clear, although
right,
it in fact does also, as it turns out, ethanol does decrease surface tension. So if you argued about water cavitation, ethanol does actually decrease the surface tension of water, and so maybe that's a factor too, it's hard to know, but the major thing obviously is that bridging business. Anyway, so we looked at ethanol for that, and looked at the first thing we established was that there was a quantitative relationship between the effect of ethanol on dissolving a hydrocarbon and the amount of exposed hydrocarbon surface. The critical thing to show, because we want to make something quantitative out of this whole business. So we showed that compounds with one phenyl ring, no matter what they had on them, might have grossly different solubilities in water, depending on what the polar group was, hanging on, like an amide group or whatever. But that when you added ethanol, say 10% or 20% ethanol, volume percent, when you added ethanol to the water, what you found is that there was an increase in solubility, which was the same when you translate it into free energy terms. That is, in other words, the change in free energy that one got as a result of solvating the benzene ring was the same, regardless of what was hanging on it. So, in fact, that other piece determined the original solubility, but the solubility change, that change, it turns out to be because of the way equilibrium equilibrium constants and the free energies go. You know, there's a logarithm you have to do. I mean, there's a well-defined relationship. But when we did that, we found that it was always the same amount. So that, first of all, a simple phenyl ring with a certain amount of ethanol is solubilized by a change in free energy, delta delta G, which was always the same. So that was helpful. And then we showed that if we had two phenyls in the molecule, but they were held apart, so they couldn't interact in any way. So we had three different cases of that. The simplest one was an oxirane, an ethylene oxide with a phenyl up and a phenyl down, trans, so the phenyls were clearly held apart. We found that that one had twice the free energy change with the same amount of ethanol as things with only one benzene ring. In other words, that if you doubled up the amount of hydrophobic surface, then the delta delta G, the free energy change, was twice as big. You know, it's not an unreasonable result, but you have to know that it's true. So we showed that, and then we also showed and we had a number of cases of that showing that relationship. We've also showed, as an aside, I could mention that a benzene ring and a cyclohexane have about the same delta delta G. That is, cyclohexyl compounds and phenyl compounds are increased in solubility by an amount when translated into free energy change that's the same. But then we also showed that if the phenyls could get near each other, that we didn't necessarily get doubling because the phenyls could cover up to some extent. So the first case was actually the molecule benzoin. Benzoin has two phenyls sitting on a two-carbon linker that is not, in fact, does not force the phenyls to be apart. And in that case, we saw that only seemed to be only 1.5 benzene rings in the molecule. And mm-hmm. So half of a benzene ring had disappeared from solvent contact. And that was sensible because part of the benzene ring covers mm-hmm. the other one. And so that's fair enough. But it's important to know that kind of stuff because of things that have developed later. And then we also took the oxirane, the ethylene oxide, and had the two phenyls on the same side. And then again, we got about a 1.6 benzene rings exposed rather than two. So we were covering, you know, maybe 40% total of the hydrocarbon surface area somehow. So with that kind of thing, it seemed to us that it was reasonable to start looking at reactions, because once you knew that the delta delta G was proportional to the amount of hydrocarbon surface exposed, if you could find reactions where that was the only effect of the ethanol, which is a critical point, which is not necessarily true for everything, you found one that was, oh, where that was the only effect, then in principle you could figure out how much hydrocarbon surface is exposed in the transition state, and that's the geometry of the transition state, the thing that one doesn't know. You know?
Right.
So the first thing we did is a couple of cases where we knew for sure what the result was going to be, just to make sure that it got the right result. So we did the Diels-Alder dimerization of cyclopentadiene. Now, when these two rings come together, each one more or less covers the face of the other one, because in water they give entirely the endo addition and no exo bond. So they come in a very compact transition state, and we thought, well, they must each be covering one face of the other. So we ought to have about one cyclopentadiene more or less disappearing from contact. The ambiguity is that you can cover one face of each one, but you still have the edges. So you have the other faces that are exposed, right. And you have the edges. So you probably won't cover quite one whole cyclopentadiene. And when we did the effect of the ethanol and the rate of this, not just ethanol, but we did a whole string of different alcohols. At that point, we were just exploring mm-hmm. this whole area. We found that we could see what they did to the solubility of cyclopentadiene. That was a calibrator for the whole surface. And then what did they do to the rate? And it was a very good correlation over a whole range of different co-solvents that 90% of acyclopentadiene was disappearing in the transition state, which is mm-hmm. about what you'd expect for covering the two surfaces. So that looked good. So that looked as if, well, maybe you could do the stuff and learn about transition states. Then we also did a Diels-Alder reaction series on an anthracene compound. It was an anthracene carbonyl because we needed to be in solution, but it was a species we had actually studied before, as it turned out, early on in the... In our early work on Diels-Alder before we got into this quantitative stuff, and so we looked at an anthracene carbonyl reaction with N-methyl maleimide, and it turns out there that what you find is that you are covering about 27% of the anthracene in the transition state. Again, assuming that this is only a hydrophobic, you know, thing changing, you know, changing anything else. And, you know, again, that for the cyclopentadiene, it's pretty clear there won't be any polar solvent effects. For this maleimbin anthracene carbonyl, you'll have to wonder whether maybe there is any kind of polar effect on the dienophile. But in fact, you know, we just checked, and sure enough, we got 27%, which means you're covering about half of one surface of the anthracene, a little more than half, and that's what it should be for the Diels alder going right over the middle ring. It, in fact, will cover half of the middle ring of the anthracene and the whole benzene on the other side. But then you can also look at the solubility of the Diels alder adduct and look at how it changes with ethanol. And when you do that, that tells you how much hydrocarbon surface is now exposed in the product. And 90% of it came, it was there then again. In other words, because you do a Diels alder like that, but then it goes like this in the product, and you re-expose the hydrocarbon surface. So that all made very good sense. And so we said, gee, this stuff really makes a lot of sense, you know? And so then we went back to our benzoin condensation to see how that will look with this ethanol story. And that was a little trickier again, because obviously you've got a charged anion heading a carbonyl, and so will there be polar effects? Who knows, you know, someone has to worry about that. But we decided, oh, let's see how it looks. And so we ran that case, and it turned out that from the same argument about looking at benzaldehyde, delta-delta Gs, you know, the free energy changes, and then looking at the rate effects, we could deduce that about one-third of a benzene had disappeared. One-third of the total hydrocarbon surface had disappeared in the transition state, whereas in the final product, benzoin, it was one-half eventually gone. And so that really meant, that was from the solubility, early solubility studies.
Right.
And so that said, well, okay, we're on our way in, but we are not coming in with these two phenyls lying fully on top of each other, because that would give you a big effect.
Right.
We're coming in at an angle. And then when you think about it, you realize, well, that makes good sense, because to add to the carbonyl doesn't stick straight out. It sticks out at an angle. You got to come in behind the carbonyl.
Right.
And as soon as you come in behind the carbonyl, you're getting only partial occlusion of those things. So whether one-third is the precisely right number, I guess one has no other evidence for, but at least it was not an unreasonable number.
Right.
And so with all of that, we decided, okay, we could afford to get into things that were a little riskier. And so we've done that. And the risky part had to do with getting into things where there were real charges being made and broken in transition states, and how much can you ignore other effects of these co-solvents in changing the dielectric constant of the medium and that kind of stuff. So we did a couple of control reactions, which actually looked pretty good, but I think we now realize that we went back and did more extensive control reactions now. In fact, what I've got in my computer right now is the report of that stuff, because I was not happy. We had a few control reactions where we didn't seem to see any effect of adding ethanol on things like hydroxylamine hitting chloroacetate ion and things of that kind, where you're clearly getting charged groups, and yet the rates didn't change with ethanol. But I was not satisfied that this really made, that this was enough to establish the whole thing. But we've now done a bunch of control reactions, and where we are right now, we're right in the middle of sorting this whole story out. There are, sure enough, small reactions, displacement reactions, where putting in, say, 10 volume percent ethanol or 20 volume percent ethanol does have an effect on the rates, and has nothing to do with hydrophobicity, because there are charges that whose solvation change. But we've been able to sort that out with a very interesting trick, and this also, as I say, is something that's just being written up now. If we substituted dimethyl sulfoxide for ethanol in the water, what we found was that dimethyl sulfoxide is about 50% better than ethanol at the same volume concentration in solubilizing hydrocarbons. So it's even more anti-hydrophobic. I mean, it's got those two methyls that it packs right against the benzene ring, and then it's got this sulfoxide sticking out into the water, and so it's a terrific solvent. On the other hand, the dielectric constant of the water doesn't go down seriously at all with DMSO dissolved as compared to ethanol.
Right.
And so we're able to sort out a dielectric constant effect then from a hydrophobic effect. And with that, we were able to show that in, for instance, the nucleophilic reaction of N-methyl aniline on benzyl chloride, that there is, sure enough, an anti-hydrophobic effect operating, as well as whatever is going on with some solvating of the developing charges. I mean, when N-methyl aniline hits benzyl chloride, you generate a chloride, it's got to get solvated. You generate an analinium cation, it's got to get solvated, you know, with a hydrogen bond and all that. So there are polar effects there, but we're able to sort them out with this trick. And see that there sure enough is an anti-hydrophobic effect there. But the situation is a little more complex than that, because some of the anti-hydrophobic effect comes from a phenomenon that we found that people had, well, nobody had worried about any of this stuff, so nobody knew about this either. But it turns out that if you have a neutral, like a benzyl chloride, and if in the transition state you develop benzyl cation character, that charge gets delocalized into the benzene ring, that benzene becomes less hydrophobic as a result. So you can diminish its unhappiness of contact with water by just getting charged into the ring. And we showed that that was true. We also showed that that was true with, say, a phenoxide anion. If you go from phenoxide anion to a neutral phenyl ether or something, using it as a nucleophile, it starts off not hydrophobic at all. I mean, that charge is enough to make that benzene ring perfectly compatible with water, as judged by our ethanol story. On the other hand, when you go to the neutral, then in fact you get a significant hydrophobic effect. So in all these reactions, you have to worry about losing hydrophobicity in the benzyl system as you could develop some benzyl cation character, developing hydrophobicity as the phenoxide as you get, et cetera, and that in addition to whatever you get out of packing. So it's a more complicated story, which we knew it was going to be. I mean, we knew we were getting into a serious area here. But on the other hand, there are things that people have not really worried about this stuff in the ways that are really quite interesting. For instance, very early classic work by Saul Weinstein on sulfolysis said that when you went with tertiary butyl chloride sulfolysis, which is sort of one of the fundamental classic organic reactions, you look at that in water, and then you could look at that in 20 volume percent ethanol in water, which happens to be, he did it. I mean, he did the same volume that we've been looking at. It turns out the reaction is three times slower in the 20% ethanol than it is in straight water. And he argued that that was because of the change in polarity of the medium. But ethanol will solvate the tertiary butyl chloride strongly because it's a hydrophobic piece, and it's a hydrocarbon, essentially. Ethanol will solvate the starting material strongly, and when you go to the cation, you lose that. And so it's the same sort of thing as in the benzyl cation. That is, when you start putting charge into a hydrocarbon species, you will lose its hydrophobicity. In benzyl cation, and there's a lot of charge actually out on the protons even. You know, those little hydrogens and the methyl groups even carry a lot of the charge. And so the system then, we've done some calculations on this. We don't have any measurements on it. But the point is that in a lot of classic work, when people have not thought enough about this question of ethanol helping to solvate the neutral compound. And so now we started off with that being an effect we were mostly concerned with. We now have to sort that out from all these other solvation effects. So, you know, the world has gotten more complicated. Well, that's all right. We're getting out.
But then you used this anti-hydrophobic effect as a probe for single electron transfer as well.
Yeah, that was a case. Now that one is an interesting case. There, what we found was that with something like a thiophenoxide anion as a nucleophile, and let's see, I think our cleanest case actually is the one that we published recently in JAX, which was the cyclohexyl methyl iodide. So that was our case where we looked at a mesylate as a leaving group and an iodide as a leaving group. And we had there a big increase in the hydrophobicity of the thiophenoxide anion. So it started off as a delocalized ion, which wasn't very hydrophobic, and when it lost that charge, then there was a big increase in hydrophobicity. We got a very large number for that, as judged from the transition state, the rate effects. And we had some control. That was provided, it kicked off an iodine. Carbon iodine bond is a bond that you can cleave fairly easily with a one electron reduction. It has a very low potential for reduction, single electron reduction, whereas the carbon mesylate, the corresponding mesylate, you can't reduce. I mean, that's one of the classic kinds of things that electrochemists worry about, is the difference between something like a weak bond, like an iodine, and a strong bond, like an carbon-oxygen bond. So anyhow, what we found is that we didn't see anything like these huge effects when we're kicking a mesylate off, but we got this big effect when we kick an iodine off. So that was at least symptomatic of something going on. In addition to that, what we found is that when we kicked the mesylate off, having a hindering group, putting a couple of methyls on each side of the thiophenoxide sulfur, slowed the reaction, not a huge amount, but slowed it significantly, whereas in fact it had no effect at all in the iodine case. And so that said that the iodine, that the sulfur is a lot further from the carbon in the transition state for the iodine phase, and could be consistent with single electron transfer. I think at this point our position is probably a little more moderate than what we advanced. We said that this is evidence for a single electron transfer, but there are two interpretations of that, and I don't think we know which one is correct. One interpretation is that you are setting up what we think of as an SN2 transition state with relatively long bonds in this case, and with a serious amount of single electron transfer character in the transition state, so that the thiophene oxide is somewhere between an S minus and an S dot.
Okay.
And the carbon is somewhere between a neutral and a C dot or whatever, you know, or mm-hmm. C plus and C dot. In other words, I think there's a lot of single electron transfer in there. It's the only thing that makes any sense for this. But I think that we don't really have evidence that you go all the way to a pair of radicals which then couple.
Okay.
That is harder to do. You can do that kind of stuff in other cases, and people found it in other cases. So there are well-defined cases where you actually do a full single electron transfer and make a pair of radicals in a cage which then couple.
Right.
But generally the evidence for that is things like you lose stereochemistry. Well, we haven't been able to do that here. That would be an interesting thing, but I haven't done it. Or you get radical rearrangements in the course of the reaction. Well, this doesn't do anything like that. So we are missing some of the classic pieces of evidence for a bona fide free radical actual intermediate.
You don't see any coupling reactions or anything of that sort.
No. But you see, if this is a cage recombination of a pair of radicals,
okay.
You're not going to see
right.
You're not even going to see inhibition. We put in radical inhibitors, chain inhibitors, but these are not chain reactions, so nothing happens there either.
Right.
And it doesn't happen with any of these other classic cases. So I think at the current point, our position really would be now a little more moderate. It would say there's a lot of single electron transfer character, whether it's a full all the way to a pair of cage radicals before they couple, or whether the sulfur is already beginning to bond to the carbon before the chlorine is quite all the way gone. I think we wouldn't really be able to say. And that's an interesting challenge, which I guess we're going to have to try to figure out how to deal with. It's because I think we've become, as we've done more work, more aware of the fact that you can get a lot of increase in hydrophobicity in a thiophene oxide anion or in a phenoxide anion by simply getting most of the charge out. You don't have to get it all out. And if most of the charge is gone, you're going to get a lot. And some of this is related to calculations we've done. We developed a calculational model for this anti-hydrophobic business, which has been very helpful and which correlates pretty well with things that we know, in which, in the computer, we take a molecule, we put it in water, we bring an ethane up to it and let the ethane probe around the surface, and we try to see what happens to the free energy of that combination. In other words, the ethane was originally separate from the compound, and when they come together, there's a decrease in free energy, and by how much, you know, so that would be. And then we know that, well, in the real system where you're in water and you have some ethanol, you're not going to have 100% of the ethanol sitting on there, so that we have to calibrate that in some way. So what we did is look at the effect, the calculated effect on solubilities, on the delta-delta Gs for solubilizing hydrocarbons, and then the real effects. And we found that the calculation at 20 volume percent ethanol overestimated the effect by a factor of 4. Now, if we'd had more ethanol, presumably it would overestimate less because we'd have more chance of solvating. But so the factor of 4 is presumably some measure of, you know, to what extent ethanol is there compared to just floating around in solution, you know, because it costs you entropy to lock it there. And so then we took that, the factor of 4, and then we applied it to some of our rate effects, and it works pretty well. And so we're able to account for a lot of the things that we measure by this calculational model for what the co-solvent should do. But I don't think it's perfect yet. And so obviously we're working on that too, you know, trying to see if we can't get the model, a model, to work well, because I think ultimately, the direction physical organic chemistry has to go is to get to the point where we can calculate a lot of this stuff in really good detail and trust the calculations. And so part of this project is not just fiddling around with solvent effect, but trying to see if we can't calibrate these calculational models and come up with something that really works.
This is beeping. Whoa.